Floods have devastated wide swaths of Pakistan. Scientists say the rainfall was more severe because of climate change. Policy advisors say don't ignore the science.
It is going to cost tens and tens of billions of dollars to get Pakistan back on track. And so if we could ever look away from a climate-induced disaster before, we can't look away from this one.
I'm Carol Hills. Also ahead, authorities in Serbia's capital canceled a planned Pride March, but that has not deterred LGBTQ organizers.
And we will go out in the streets, whether they let us or not.
Plus, lots of carnations are being used in the UK to remember the Queen, a point of pride for flower growers in Turkey.
King Charles, they took a photo looking at the flowers, so we saw our flowers as well.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. More chilling news from Ukraine today. Hundreds of graves were discovered in the town of Izium in the east of the country. Wooden crosses marked with numbers were discovered by advancing Ukrainian forces. Authorities there have said that more than 400 bodies were thought to be buried at the site in a forest. We're joined now by reporter Liz Cookman, who visited the town of Izium. Liz, what did you see today there?
So prosecutors have just started their investigation today. It took 2 days to clear the area of mines so that they were safe to do so. And they began exhuming a number of bodies. There were around 445 civilians buried in soil graves, as well as one mass grave that was thought to be around 17 soldiers who were buried in there. Among those, that number, they managed to uncover at least one case of torture among civilians. A civilian was found with evidence that they had a rope around their neck and had had their hands tied and their arm broken. Whereas I saw myself several soldiers who were pulled out of the mass grave whose hands were still tied.
Are most of the bodies being exhumed civilians or soldiers?
Mostly civilians. So all have died since the start of the war, but for a number of different reasons. So some have been killed by shelling or explosions. Others died due to a lack of access to medicine or ill health. And one resident of Izium who I spoke to, whose wife died sadly on March the 7th, told me that the Russians came and forcibly dug up where she was buried. People are often buried close to their houses because there's heavy shelling, so they're buried in yards or gardens. He said the Russians arrived, they took the bodies and they reburied them in this wood on the edge of Izium, which is actually where they're buried, is next to an existing cemetery. But so far, nobody actually knows why they moved the bodies or what for.
What do officials think happened?
Officials have been saying that they believe that the bodies were moved to hide any evidence of the killings. But now the big question is, are they going to have another situation like Bucha on their hands? The head of the Regional Military Administration suggested that he is worried that it could be Bucha times Irpin, because the city of Izium has been so heavily destroyed, which is similar to the Kiev suburb of Irpin, which was very heavily damaged by artillery and missile attack.
And those two places you mentioned, Bucha and Irpin, are places where mass graves have been found and a number of Ukrainian bodies. Are there any independent experts who will be arriving on the scene in Izium to inspect the graves?
So there's been no information given out on that yet. I suspect that they will be requesting the UN or other NGO to come and especially oversee the bodies that have show signs of torture or other crimes. But this is all still very fresh. These territories have only just been liberated, and this burial site was only discovered in a couple of days ago.
Have any Ukrainians come to that area wondering if their relatives or loved ones are among those who were buried there?
Yes, I met one man who had come there looking for his wife's grave. So a lot of people are aware already that their relatives were there because Russians actually came and, as I said before, like moved them, so that they know their relatives are there, but they were not able to visit the site because the area was also a Russian military position. So they weren't able to visit. They didn't know which grave they were in. But the graves are unnamed. They are numbered and people don't know which number corresponds to them. So it'll still be a little bit of time before people get any kind of solid or concrete information about their relatives.
What are the expectations there of what will come out of this investigation in the coming days?
The expectations are that they want to ascertain if any war crimes were committed and get some answers for the families of these civilians. But also the soldiers that were involved, they want to know what happened to them. Were all 17 killed at the same time? Was it a mass killing? Were they killed over separate incidents? Were they all subject to torture? It's all still very up in the air at the moment.
How are residents of Izyum reacting to this? I mean, what are they saying to you?
Residents I spoke to said, actually, to their mind, there are mass graves all over the city, because they said every residential area, every yard, every square you go to, people have had to bury their relatives because that's how heavy the attacks were on the city. And yeah, the city is incredibly destroyed. Like, every building seems to have some kind of damage to it, some very, very heavy damage. So the civilian cost is anticipated to be quite high.
Liz Cookman is a reporter based in Ukraine. She's been speaking to us from Kharkiv, near the site of the mass graves in the liberated town of Izyum, where she visited today. Liz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
They're being called pawns in a political stunt. A group of 50 migrants, most of them from Venezuela, landed in Martha's Vineyard this week after reportedly being offered flights to somewhere safe where they could find work. But it was just the latest move in an ongoing effort by Republican politicians in Texas and Florida to protest the Biden administration's immigration policy. Julio Enriquez spent time with the people at the center of this story. He's an immigration lawyer born in Venezuela who's offering legal assistance to the migrants, and he's here in Boston. The governor of Massachusetts, Charlie Baker, says this group of migrants is being sent to a National Guard base on Cape Cod. What happens to them next?
Well, the majority of them have check-ins with ICE. These check-ins were in different locations. Some of them have check-ins as early as Monday in San Antonio, Texas. Others have check-ins in the next 15 days in Tacoma, Washington State, or in Washington, D.C., or Philadelphia. And obviously, given their current circumstances, they cannot attend these physical check-ins with ICE. So one of the things that we have been doing is informing ICE of this situation and requesting an extension and giving them the opportunity to relocate.
If they came in across the border in Texas, why are those appointments so far afield?
The appointments are based on where the migrants said that they were going to relocate.
I see. So if I understand you right, these migrants, once they got across the border, were apprehended and then released, before they got on the plane to Martha's Vineyard, their status was that they had been released and they could get jobs and get on with their lives as long as they showed up for the ICE hearings to then have their case proceed?
That is correct.
And so they're misled. They're enticed to get on this plane to Martha's Vineyard. And so at this point, their status and kind of what procedures are going to apply to them is kind of up in the air?
Well, their journey is not yet over. They still haven't relocated. They still haven't settled. So once they do that is when they will be able to start figuring out where to file, because without being settled, they can't start those procedures.
Will these migrants who landed in Martha's Vineyard and presumably coming to Cape Cod today, will they have the opportunity to seek asylum?
Well, the first thing we need to understand is these are separate individuals. They're not a homogeneous group, although they share many characteristics. They have different goals of what they want to do immediately and long-term in the United States. So the majority of them are very recent arrivals. They have not filed for asylum yet. They do have the opportunity to file for asylum. They have 1 year to do so from the date that they enter the United States. They have to seek assistance individually to file their asylum claims.
The U.S. and Venezuela do not have normal diplomatic relations. What does that mean for people from Venezuela seeking asylum here in the U.S.?
The U.S. does not recognize Maduro as the president of Venezuela. And there's a clear understanding that there are gross human rights violations and a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. But that is a far cry from being enough for an asylum being granted. An asylum application needs to show that they individually have a risk of persecution if they return to their country. The fact that there are gross human rights violations occurring in their country, a step in the right direction, but not enough for an asylum application to be granted.
Finally, is there any chance that any of the migrants who arrived in Martha's Vineyard and are now heading to the Cape, is there any chance that they can be relocated and stay in Massachusetts?
Yes, the migrants now have the ability to make their own decisions and decide where to go. And they can perfectly decide to stay in Massachusetts. From what I heard from several of them, they will be trying to remain in Massachusetts and look for opportunities here.
Julio Enriquez is an immigration attorney in Boston. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Grocery stores and florists in London are running out of cut flowers. Mourners paying their respects to the late Queen Elizabeth II have been scooping them up. Many of these carnations are coming from Turkey. The World's Duri Buskarin reports from the southern Turkish region of Isparta, where they're scrambling to keep up.
As she walks down a row of carnation plants, Aysel Korkmaz cuts each flower with a pair of scissors and places it on a makeshift rack at eye level. Each stem is at least 42 centimeters long, with buds just about to bloom, ready for the week-long truck ride north to the United Kingdom. Korkmaz says this variety is her favorite, a vibrant dark pink carnation called Picasso. She says she's never really followed the British royal family. Life is too busy for that, she says. Not much actually changed for us when the Queen died, she says, standing between two rows of spray carnations. We live on the farm, we go to work, we eat. Derya Yılmaz, who's cutting flowers on the other side of the row, agrees. We saw it on the news, and we were sad as fellow humans, she says, but that's about it. Yılmaz and Korkmaz harvest carnations in the cool early morning hours. After breakfast, they trim, sort, and wrap the flowers in a warehouse. Central Turkey's Flower Exporters Association estimates that local growers will send 1.5 million stems to the UK during the mourning period for the late Queen. That's about twice as many as usual this time of year. Many exporters are sending shipments on cargo planes instead of trucks or ships so they can reach British buyers sooner. Others are bringing in temporary workers or asking employees to work overtime to meet demand.
It's a labor-intense product.
Seval Oz, a co-founder of New Day Farms, says her company is struggling to fill the extra orders from the UK. She says carnations are budget flowers. They're like the workhorses of the flower world. Relatively cheap, easy to ship, good in bouquets. But they're sensitive to insects like thrips, which come over after nearby fields of wheat are harvested.
And you have to be all the time alert to any changes on the crop. You always need to monitor closely the product. I mean, your eyes should be always open.
Snowstorms damaged several grow centers in Isparta over the winter, making this carnation season a particularly challenging one. But Oz had a moment of pride while watching coverage of the Queen's son greeting mourners on the news.
King Charles, the new King Charles. They took a photo looking at the flowers. So we saw our flowers as well. I saw our flowers.
She recognized the exact type of carnation she grows in a plastic sleeve from the supermarket, Sainsbury's, one of her clients. It was just a simple bouquet. But to Oz and her colleagues, it was the end result of a year of hard work. For The World, I'm Duri Buskarin in Isparta, Turkey.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Ukraine's armies have had a series of successes recently, including one we don't often hear about, the IT Army of Ukraine. Their ranks are filled with IT professionals, you might say computer hackers, from around the world. They're civilians working together to defend Ukraine against Russian cyber attacks. When Ukraine's IT Army started 6 months ago, it was a bit of a ragtag group. But as Dina Temple-Raston, host of the Click Here podcast, reports, they've grown into a much more conventional force.
What's the best way for us to refer to you?
You can refer to me as IT Army Admin, if it's okay with you. Admin for short.
Okay.
Because my circumstances didn't change from the last time we spoke to each other.
We last spoke to Admin back in March, and his circumstances and the reason we agreed not to use his name have to do with where he's living. He's in Kyiv. When we last checked in with him, he used to have to take his parents into the basement during rocket attacks. They've moved, so he doesn't have to do that anymore.
One of the reasons why it's that we are not living in an important area of a town, so there are not much targets to attack.
And he says there have been big changes for the IT army in the past 6 months, too. They've become much more professional and organized.
At the start, we faced a few problems with the trust, with the dependability on each other. Right now, I am ready to say that we became like a hub for digital resistance here in Ukraine.
A hub for digital resistance, he says. They're organizing hundreds of thousands of people who want to help Ukraine keep Russia busy on the cyber front.
We connected more than a few groups together. We connected many talented people to help us build tools, to manage our activity, to search for new targets. We became much bigger, much better.
People all over the world wanted to volunteer, which the IT army welcomed, but it was hard to tell who was friend or who was foe. They knew that Russian agents were trying to infiltrate the group.
The problem of trust that we faced at the start of the war, it still haunts us. It's kind of hard to share some crucial information with the people you don't trust.
So they set up systems to assess the volunteers and protect against infiltration and sabotage. They have silos of information, things on a need-to-know basis. The group has weekly meetings and special channels only its leadership can access. They have a special committee that does targeting, and then they send that up the chain. They try to limit their interaction to when big decisions need to be made.
If someone have a question, we don't really like put on a big call for it. We can discuss it fast enough with the team. Is it important to make a decision quicker? Then yeah, we can make a call sooner.
With these systems in place, they were able to take in and work with volunteers from Poland, the United States, the Hacker Collective Anonymous, people from all over the world.
So how big are you now?
It's usually better to be quiet about the numbers.
Can you give me an idea of how much bigger you are than 6 months ago?
I believe I will not exaggerate if I tell you that, yeah, we are doubled in size.
Wow. From all over the world?
Yes. We still have more users from Ukraine because it's our war. It's our problem. But it's always nice to see people joining from other sides of the world, cheering for us, trying to do their best to help.
And using Telegram and other chat channels, the IT Army's hundreds of thousands of members have managed to do some really amazing things, like a denial of service attack that delayed President Vladimir Putin's opening speech at Russia's equivalent of Davos.
Russia's president today giving his annual speech at the forum after a delay caused by what the Kremlin calls massive cyber attacks.
Hackers helping the IT Army stole 20 million Russian cell phone numbers. And they built a website that allows people to message Russians directly to tell them the truth about the war. Others created a system that allowed people to log and report Russian troop movements. And while the attack on Russia's Davos was just a simple denial of service operation, it did what it needed to do. It embarrassed Putin. It told the world that, no, everything isn't fine in Russia. Things aren't normal. And that's the IT Army's MO. It doesn't launch big, complicated attacks. It's behind lots of little irritating ones. And, Admin told us, about 24 key people are behind the decisions to do that.
I can't count the number of people who are busy with executing tasks, but on a higher level, I mean. If we're talking about the decision makers, it's around 25 general leaders.
All Ukrainian?
Yes.
So the control of the IT army is in the hands of Ukrainian professionals.
Yes.
Everyone seems to agree that the IT Army's antics have kept Russian hackers so busy defending the motherland, it's cut back on the time they have to attack Ukrainian networks. In fact, the head of Britain's Signals Intelligence Service, GCHQ, recently tipped his hat to the IT Army, saying they were an important part of the most effective cyber defense in history. Just as Ukraine surprised the world by holding off Russia on the ground, its cyber forces are punching above their weight in cyberspace, too.
I believe that we will be victorious, that we will take back all our land, all the other territories that we lost. But I'm not sure that it will happen by the end of the year, because from what I can see, Russia is slowly preparing for long-term war.
For the world, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina is the host of the Click Here podcast about all things cyber and intelligence. And now a note about a friend and former colleague. Bob Ferrante was executive producer of The World from 1998 to 2011. Yesterday, we learned that he died. He was 87. Ferrante, as he was known by many, had a career in broadcast journalism that spanned more than 50 years. He covered the Kennedy assassination, later held senior jobs at CBS and NPR, and helped shape the growth and influence of network news and the sound of public radio. Here at The World, Bob fostered curiosity and smart, creative journalism. And he was always a staunch defender of telling the news like it is, no soft peddling. And he was also a character. When you heard Ferrante utter phrases like, "Jesus, Mary, and Joseph," in his inimitable Boston accent, you knew you needed to pay attention to him. And we're glad we did. Ferrante, we'll miss you. You're listening to The World. The Federal Reserve says it will do whatever it takes to tamp down American inflation. But raising interest rates in the U.S. could create ripple effects across the globe and boomerang.
If you put undue stress on the global economy through your actions, it will wash back onto the U.S. economy.
That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Serbia's capital city of Belgrade is hosting EuroPride for the first time. It's a week of LGBTQ pride events that's hosted by a different European city each year. It includes drag performances, panels, art galleries, and fashion shows. But the main event, a march set for tomorrow evening, has been touch and go all week. Serbia's government and far-right groups have wanted it banned. The World's Bianca Hillier has the latest.
Filip Vulović remembers the moment when Belgrade Pride won the Euro 2022 bid 3 years ago.
We were really excited. We didn't expect that to happen.
Vulović has been part of the organization since 2018 and says securing the 2022 bid was a major accomplishment. It's the first Euro Pride event in Southeast Europe. But same-sex marriage is not legally recognized in Serbia. And according to a 2020 survey by civil rights defenders, more than half of the population considers being gay a disease. So winning the EuroPride bid wasn't a sign of progress itself.
This meant it is time for progress to be made, because we saw that Europe and the international community believes that Serbia is ready to become part of the European culture.
That culture, Vulović says, includes upholding a strong democracy and respecting human rights, including LGBTQ rights.
It was just an opportunity for us to push for those rights in a society which is deeply conservative, as Serbia is.
But late last month, the plan hit a roadblock. In a televised press conference, Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić said the Euro Pride parade was canceled. He didn't think Belgrade's authorities could provide enough security to keep everyone safe from anti-LGBTQ groups who threatened to disrupt the event. The announcement took Goran Milicic by surprise. He's a member of the Euro Pride 2022 organizing committee.
No, we were not aware that he will make a statement.
Miletic says he was having regular meetings with members of the government, police, and City Hall.
And they never ever mentioned that there is a problem.
The president's announcement prompted a series of anti-Pride protests through Belgrade. Many people carried Russian and Serbian flags. One banner read, "Save our children and families." Filip Vulović says that sentiment is something he often hears from anti-LGBTQ Serbians.
Their anti-Pride slogan has been, "Brajte zvučati zida, get back into your four walls. Do not expose yourself. We don't hate you. We don't want to beat you up. Just stay away from our kids."
This, Vulović says, is why marching through the streets is so important.
The Pride March in Serbia is still in majority a protest, and we will go out in the streets whether they let us or not, and we will try and gather and protest and march.
International support has been pouring in. In the European Parliament this week, Germany's Terry Reintke received a standing ovation for backing LGBTQ Serbians.
We are in very close contact both with the Serbian government as well as with the Pride organizers. We are a parliament that stands for the fundamental right of freedom of assembly and with the LGBTI community all across the European Union and in Serbia and in Europe. Thank you very much.
By midweek, the police had also called off the march. But LGBTQ activists planned to carry on anyway. Goran Miletic says that they've dealt with this situation before.
We had 4 bans of Pride so far in Serbia in 2009, 2011, 12, and 13. All 4 bans of Pride were declared unconstitutional by the Constitutional Court of Serbia.
Determined to march, Pride organizers got crafty. Since the original route was banned, yesterday they created a new route and submitted it to authorities. This time, it was accepted. Here's Christine Garina with the European Pride Organizers Association.
The latest word is that it's back on, so it's really confusing.
Garina thinks international pressure and support from top European leaders made Serbia reverse course. The president's office did not immediately reply to a request for comment. Whatever the reason, Garina says the back and forth has ended up being the biggest marketing campaign EuroPride could ask for.
It's attracted all the international attention, so in that way it's good. But it's also really, really bad because for the people here, it's a terrible sign that their government is just banning them, unbanning them, using them like political games. So it's really terrible for the LGBT people here in Serbia and the entire Balkans.
The march is now scheduled for tomorrow night at 5:30 in Belgrade. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Now to Pakistan, to a story we've been keeping close tabs on, the record flooding there. Around 1,500 people have been killed and more than 33 million have been displaced by rising waters. Hundreds of villages are completely submerged and unlivable. Volunteers have been working to provide essential items to some of the people impacted. One of them is Tazir Tareen. He's from Nazirabad, a district in western Pakistan. My colleague Marco Werman spoke with him. He started by asking Tazir to describe the kinds of images and videos he's been posting on social media.
I made videos of demonstrations, the flood water and the level of waters. I posted in my group, the Karakoram Club, and then I asked for volunteers and donations. The group administrations took it very serious, and they spread my words and my story as far as they can. And honestly telling you, the response were overwhelming, and that we could collect a huge figure from all over the country and abroad as well.
What really impressed you about what you were seeing, the pictures that you took, the videos that you took? I mean, had you ever seen anything like that in Pakistan?
There is a house that was built in front of my eyes, and that house was very close to my heart. That they got destroyed overnight due to heavy rain and flood water. It was about evening of 20 August, and it was raining nonstop for 48 hours, and rain started smashing everything. I was there till late night before the house collapsed, but due to huge heavy rain, I came back to my position, and then very next day in morning, when I came out, I just saw water everywhere and people with their belongings, they saved all over the night.
What is the day-to-day planning like for your group? How do you figure out where to go and what to do?
We first made a 10-day plan, which was the part of the first phase of our relief campaign, under which we used to mobilize teams. And the plan was very simple, and that was arrange cooked food and clean water as we can and supply it to the doorsteps of the affectees.
Where have all the people gone whose homes have been destroyed? And is that where you go when you're helping them out?
It's NA65 National Highway. All people gather on National Highway and they make temporary shelters, what they collect from their belongings during flooding.
And how do you actually get supplies to people in washed out villages?
Actually, my team consists of local volunteers, and local volunteers know every path and every route to the people villages. When people came to National Highway, we use to supply our meals and other things to people by using carts and rickshaws and some small vehicles.
So you mentioned the first and second phase of your club's volunteer operation. The third phase is aiming to get people working again with sustainable livelihoods. How are you planning to do that?
Yes, of course, we are preparing ourselves for phase three, which is totally based on construction. So if it works, then we will be able to make affectees get back to their homes before the coming winters. This time, people have only one demand, and that is their homes. They want to get homes as soon as possible.
Tazir, why is it important for you to do this work?
It's great experience that can't be described in the words. Helping people, fulfilling their wishes, solving their problems, and content faces of the kids. It's everything for us. So that make us strive.
That was Tazir Tareen speaking with the world's Marco Werman. Tazir is leading a team of volunteers to provide food, water, and shelter to people impacted by the floods in Pakistan. Many authorities in Pakistan are blaming climate change for the intensity of the rains and historic flooding in their country. A new scientific analysis supports that. The world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler has more.
Pakistan has a rainy season every summer, but this one was supercharged. About 7 or 8 times the usual amount of rain fell over the southern half of the country in August.
I have just returned from Pakistan, where I looked through a window into the future.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told reporters this week that that future is one of permanent and ubiquitous climate chaos. The floods in Pakistan demonstrate, he says,
the sheer inadequacy of the global response to the climate crisis and the betrayal and injustice at the heart of it.
A new scientific analysis released yesterday begins to paint the picture. It found that as much as a third of the rain that fell over southern Pakistan over a particularly intense 5-day period was due to climate change.
An up to 50% or 75% increase in intensity of rainfall is huge, and especially in a region that is very vulnerable.
Frederica Otto from Imperial College London is one of the authors of the analysis produced by the World Weather Attribution Group.
That would have been disastrously high rainfall event without climate change, but it's worse because of climate change. And especially in these highly vulnerable regions, small changes matter a lot.
Otto says the drivers of the record rainfall are complex, and not every climate model finds such a strong impact from climate change. In any case, climate change itself wasn't the biggest cause of the humanitarian crisis, she says. Existing vulnerabilities in Pakistan were more to blame. One problem, infrastructure, like dams that are set up more to harness water for power and irrigation than to protect local communities from flooding. Another of the study's authors, Ayesha Siddiqui from the University of Cambridge, says development and urbanization in flood-prone riverbeds also drove the damage.
Especially buildings that block natural watercourses have also exacerbated some of these problems. Now the water stagnates and there's really nowhere to go. And we're seeing this in some of the places in the lower Indus Basin right now.
The scientists point out it's hard to tease out precisely how climate change impacts the rainy season in Pakistan. That's partly because the monsoon season there has always been highly variable.
So that means that you have very dry years, but some years that have very heavy rainfall.
Here's Frederica Otto again.
But we only have data since 1950. And so there's just not enough data to really quantify the changes in the likelihood of such an event to occur.
Pakistan just had an unusually cold winter, followed by record-breaking heat in April and May. That heat wave was fueled by climate change, and it turbocharged this summer's monsoon. Ghulam Rasool, who wasn't involved in the study, said the heavy rains drenched parts of the country that don't usually get them.
The losses, these are unimaginable. This is the largest flood, not due to riverine flooding. This is monsoon flooding. This is rainfall flooding.
Rasool is the former head of Pakistan's National Meteorological Agency.
I'm 62, 63 years, and I had never seen such a horrible scene in Pakistan.
Pakistan's climate minister has already called for richer countries to do more to help developing countries deal with the impacts of climate change. The floods are likely to be a major theme as leaders gather next week at the United Nations General Assembly in New York.
The backdrop of this is Pakistan.
Rachel Kite is the dean of the Graduate School of Global Affairs at Tufts University.
Pakistan is devastated. It is going to cost tens and tens of billions of dollars to get Pakistan back on track. And so if we could ever look away from a climate-induced disaster before, we can't look away from this one.
Kite says there's some hope that this disaster will push nations to find common ground on an issue that's been divisive for years. Who will pay for the damage caused by extreme weather events in the countries that are least responsible for climate change? For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
This next story is about driving in Sweden and what happens when a moose crosses the road in front of your car. That's a video from the Swedish National Road and Transport Research Institute from a test conducted by engineer Magnus Gentz.
When I first started out, this was a really important topic that we knew very little about.
Gentz's work caught the eye of Mark Abrams, director of the Annals of Improbable Research and its annual awards competition.
We get something like 10,000 new nominations in a typical year.
The Ig Nobel Prizes go to research that makes you laugh and then makes you think. So why did this research from Sweden get a prize?
That's self-evident. It's a crash test dummy.
Okay, that is funny.
And what's also important to understand is that the whole outset of creating this moose crash test dummy is to understand what kind of damages can be done to vehicles by these large animals out on the Swedish roads, or not only Swedish roads, but all the parts in the world where these big animals reside.
Gentz designed the dummy to simulate the weight and mass of a real moose. It's constructed from thick rubber plates and slung from a frame by wires. Gentz took the moose dummy to the Swedish carmaker Saab and installed it on the test track. A new Saab and an old Volvo with human-shaped test dummies were propelled toward the moose dummy at about 50 miles per hour. It sounded like this. The takeaway from Gentz's research? A car is no match for a moose. If you see a moose trying to cross in front of you, don't speed up.
Most drivers, they try to pass the moose in front of the moose because that's just what feels most natural at that point of time.
But if a collision is inevitable, Magnus Gentz says aim for the rear end of the moose. Really? That kind of no-nonsense advice earned the Swedish engineer one of the 10 tongue-in-cheek honors given out at the 32nd annual Ig Nobel Awards last night. Hundreds of people joined President Biden at the White House this week to celebrate the passing of the Inflation Reduction Act.
A single most important legislation passed in the Congress to combat inflation and one of the most significant laws in our nation's history, in my view.
Perhaps, but U.S. inflation remains stubbornly high, up 8.3% since last year, even higher in some parts of the country. The Federal Reserve plans to keep raising interest rates to bring down inflation and to pump the brakes on the U.S. economy. But doing that could also create some serious ripple effects across the globe. My colleague Marco Werman spoke with Julia Coronado about this. She's a former Federal Reserve economist and founder of Macro Policy Perspectives. Here's Marco.
Julia, when the U.S. raises interest rates here at home, what effect does it have on other countries?
First of all, the U.S. economy is one of the engines of growth of the global economy. So if the Federal Reserve is slowing the U.S. economy, then the whole global economy slows. The other thing that it does is that it tends to put upward pressure on the value of the dollar. So we have seen the dollar appreciate quite rapidly this year as the Fed raises interest rates. That makes imports for other countries more expensive at a time when all countries are grappling with high inflation. If your currency is weakening against the dollar, you're sort of importing inflation in addition to whatever domestic inflation you have. There is a lot of research in economics that shows that the dominance of the dollar effectively means that the Fed is kind of setting monetary policy not just for the U.S., but for the global economy. So nobody is untouched by this.
What does that mean for average people and their day-to-day lives in emerging economies like India, Brazil, or say Mexico?
Those countries that you just cited are already dealing with kind of a rocky path. Their central banks have also had to raise interest rates. They have also been dealing with high inflation. So it just means a volatile and uncertain time for those economies. Many of them will experience recessions, particularly for emerging markets. You could see capital fleeing these countries, so less money to invest and generate new growth.
And if a bunch of central banks around the globe are all raising interest rates and they're not kind of synchronized, what's the potential result of that?
Often you'll hear central bankers say that they only have blunt tools. When the Fed is raising rates and all central bankers are raising rates, there's a greater chance that they'll go too far. We haven't seen the Fed raise interest rates this fast since the 80s. Similarly, we've just seen the European Central Bank raise interest rates faster than it has in decades. No central bank is trying to create a recession. Everybody would like a soft landing, but the inflation pressures have surged so quickly and so high, they really do feel that their credibility that they worked so hard to establish is at stake, and they're going to err on the side of doing too much.
Can you make the argument, Julia, that it's in the U.S. best interest to sacrifice some of our own economic health for the sake of global economic health?
I don't think the Fed would ever frame it that way, but I think there is an understanding that the global economy is tied together. If you put undue stress on the global economy through your actions, it will wash back onto the U.S. economy. You know, you can't calibrate your policy just to the U.S. without thinking about these feedback channels from the global economy.
That was Julia Coronado, a former Federal Reserve economist and founder of Macro Policy Perspectives, speaking with the world's Marco Werman. The Fisk Jubilee Singers have been traveling the globe for more than 150 years, performing African-American spirituals. They're based out of Fisk University in Nashville. Paul Kwame was the choir's first African-born director. He died last weekend. His commitment to the group's legacy carried them through several remarkable milestones. Colleen Phelps interviewed Kwame last year and has this remembrance.
Growing up in Ghana, Paul Kwame had no idea who the Fisk Jubilee Singers were. But he definitely knew their songs. He recalled sitting at his father's feet at age four, hearing a visiting choir perform a spiritual.
Every time I feel the spirit move in my heart, I will pray. I can still see a picture of that choir of the room where we were for this concert.
Kwame came to the United States in 1983 to study music education at Fisk University, a historically black university in Nashville. He hadn't planned on participating in any extracurriculars, but being accepted to the Fisk Jubilee Singers was a moment that changed his life. The group started touring in 1871, first the U.S. and then Europe. Money they raised on tour helped build some of Fisk University's oldest buildings, including their iconic Jubilee Hall. As I interviewed Dr. Kwame, we looked together at the portrait of the Jubilee Singers of the 1870s, gifted to the school by Queen Victoria. I asked, what would you want to tell them?
I wish they would know today that we are still talking about them still admiring them for what they did.
In 1994, Kwame became the ensemble's director, a position he held for the rest of his life. And while he carried the weight of the legacy, he also saw the music's positive impact on the students right there in the present.
Some students may come into a rehearsal with personal problems. Their emotions always flow through the songs that we sing.
Under Kwame's leadership, the Fisk Jubilee Singers won awards including a Grammy, a Dove Award, and the Presidential Medal of the Arts. They performed at the Apollo, Carnegie Hall, and the White House. And in 2007, quite meaningfully, in Kwame's homeland of Ghana, as part of the country's Year of Jubilee, recording spirituals in Elmina Castle, a historic location from the Atlantic slave trade.
Our prayer that day was that our music would be embedded in the grounds and walls of that castle so that anyone who would walk in there would experience the forgiveness and peace of God.
Paul Kwame died last weekend in Nashville at the age of 70. For The World, I'm Colleen Phelps.
And that's where we wrap things up for the week. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.